Let's begin.
You have 5 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Don't worry if you can't follow everything that is said.
Now repeat.
Hi, I'm Brianna from Colony. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
Tune in to Quintron's Weather Warlock, a custom-built weather-controlled analog synthesizer that turns the changes in the weather into sounds. New Orleans-based artist Quintron installed one of his series of custom-built weather-controlled analog synthesizers in the Wavefarm Study Center, with sensors outside detecting the differences and changes in the weather. Here, the precipitation, the sunlight, the wind, and the temperature turned into soundscapes anytime, 24 hours a day, at wavefarm.org/listen, or click on the listen button at any WGXC.org page. One of the many web streams available to listen anytime, Quintron's Weather Warlock, available through Wavefarm.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry if there was a couple of seconds of weird feedback there. But good morning. It's February 5th, 2024. And the leap year is upon us. And you are listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, in the name of the show, Good Night, Norman, right here on WGXC 90.7 FM in the beautiful Hudson Valley. Suppose it's what they call a Black History Month. You'd think someone like me, someone who's purportedly 76% sub-Saharan African and 23% Northumbrian, One percent South Asian, might read something black. But I don't think there's any such thing as black history, since history is written by the victors. I don't think that there's any such thing. So I'm going to read some Roberto Bolaño. How about that? Roberto Bolaño's from Chile, but he's dead. Been dead for a while. But he did leave behind some writings. I'm going to read Gomez. I don't know what to read. I'm going to read Gomez Palacio. No, maybe I'll read the Mexican Manifesto. The Mexican Manifesto was written before he died. I think he died of some weird kind of cancer. But anyways, who cares? He's dead, and this was translated from the Spanish by Laura Healy. Mexican Manifesto by Roberto Bolaño. Laura and I did not make love that afternoon. In truth, we gave it a shot, but it just didn't happen. Or at least, that's what I thought at the time. Now I'm not so sure. We probably did make love. That's what Laura said. And while we were at it, she introduced me to the world of public baths, which from then on and for a very long time, I would associate with pleasure and play. The first one was without a doubt the best. It was called Montezuma's Gym. And in the foyer, some unknown artist had done a mural where you could see the Aztec emperor neck deep in a pool. Around the edges, close to the monarch, but much smaller, smiling men and women bathe. Everyone seems carefree except the king, who looks fixedly out of the mural, as if searching for the improbable spectator with dark, wide-open eyes, in which I often thought I glimpsed terror. The water in the pool is green, the stones are gray. In the background, you can see mountains and storm clouds. The boy who worked at Montezuma's gym was an orphan, and that was his primary topic of conversation. On the third visit, we became friends. He was only 18 and wanted to buy a car, so he was saving everything he could, and tips were scant. According to Laura, he was a little slow. I thought he was nice. In every public bath, there tends to be a fight from time to time. We never saw or heard any there. The clients, conditioned by some unknown mechanism, respected and obeyed every word of the orphan's instructions. Also, to be fair, there weren't very many people, and that's something I'll never be able to explain, since it was a clean place, relatively modern, with individual saunas for taking steam baths, bar service in the saunas, and above all, cheap. There in sauna 10, I saw Laura naked for the first time, and all I could do was smile and touch her shoulder and say I didn't know which valve to turn to make the steam come out. The saunas, though it might be more precise to call them private rooms, were a set of two tiny chambers connected by a glass door. In the first, there was usually a divan, an old divan, reminiscent of psychoanalysis and bordellos, a folding table, and a coat rack. The second chamber was the actual steam bath with a hot and cold shower and a bench of azulejo tiles against the wall, beneath which were hidden the tubes that released the steam. Moving from one vestibule to the next was extraordinary, especially if the steam was already so thick that we couldn't see each other. Then we would open the door and head into the chamber with the divan, where everything was clear, and behind us, like the filaments of a dream, clouds of steam slipped by and quickly disappeared. Lying there, holding hands, we would listen, or try to listen, to the barely perceptible sounds of the gym while our bodies cooled. Practically freezing, submerged in silence, we would finally hear the purr welling up through the floor and the walls, the cat-like whir of hot pipes and boilers that stoked the business from some secret place in the building. One day I'll wander around in here, Laura said. Her experience raiding public baths was greater than mine, which wasn't saying much considering I'd never before crossed the threshold of such an establishment. Nevertheless, she said she knew nothing of baths, not enough. She'd gone a couple of times with X, and before X, with a guy who was twice her age and whom she always referred to with mysterious phrases. In total, she hadn't been more than 10 times. Always to the same place, Montezuma's gym. Together, riding a Benelli, they were everywhere then, we attempted to visit all the baths in Mexico City, guided by an absolute eagerness that was a combination of love and play. We never succeeded. On the contrary, as we advanced, the abyss opened up around us, the great black scenography of public baths. Just as the hidden face of other cities is in theaters, parks, docks, beaches, labyrinths, churches, brothels, bars, cheap cinemas, old buildings, even supermarkets, the hidden face of Mexico City could be found in the enormous web of public baths, legal, semi-legal, and clandestine. Setting our course was simple at first. I asked the boy at Montezuma's gym to point me in the direction of some cheap baths. I got 5 cards and wrote the addresses of 12 establishments on a piece of paper. These were the first. From them, our search branched off countless times. The schedules varied as much as the buildings did. We arrived at some at 10 a.m. and left at lunchtime. These, as a rule, were bright places with flaking walls, where we could sometimes hear the laughter of teenagers and the coughing of lost and lonely men, the same men who, a little while later, having collected themselves, would get up and sing boleros. The essence of those places seemed to be limbo, a dead child's closed eyes. They weren't very clean, or maybe the cleaning was done later in the day. At others, we'd make our appearance at 4 or 5 in the afternoon and wouldn't leave until dark. That was our most common schedule. The baths at that hour seemed to enjoy or suffer from a permanent shadow. That is, a trick shadow, a dome, or a palm tree, the closest thing to a marsupial's pouch. At first, you're grateful for it, but it ends up weighing more than a tombstone. The baths were most crowded at 7:30, 8 at night. On the sidewalk next to the door, teenagers stood guard, talking about baseball and pop songs. The hallways echoed with the sinister jokes of workers who just come from factories and workshops. In the foyer, old fags, birds of passage, would greet the receptionist and those killing time in the armchairs by first name, or nom de guerre. Getting lost in the hallways, nourishing a kind of indiscretion in small doses, like pinches, never ceased to be highly informative. Open or half-open doors, like landslides, like clack cracks in the earth, usually offered live paintings to the happy observer, groups of naked men who left all movement and action entirely to the steam. Teenagers, lost like jaguars in a labyrinth of showers, small but terrifying gestures of athletes, bodybuilders, and loners, a leper's clothes hanging, little old men drinking lulu and smiling as they leaned against the wooden door of the Turkish bath. It was easy to make friends, and we did make some. Couples, after passing a few times in the hallways, felt obliged to greet one another. This was owing to a kind of heterosexual solidarity. Women, in many public baths, were an absolute minority, and it wasn't uncommon to hear extravagant stories of attacks and harassment, even though, truth is, those tales weren't very credible. These kinds of friendships rarely went beyond a beer or a drink in the bar. We'd say hi to one another in the baths, and at most, we'd take neighboring saunas. After a while, the first to finish would knock on their friend's door and, without waiting for an answer, holler that they'd be in such and such restaurant, waiting. Then the others would leave. They'd go to the restaurant, have a drink or two, and say goodbye until next time. Sometimes the couple would take you into their confidence, the woman or the man, especially if they were married, but not to each other. They'd tell about their lives, and you'd have to nod, Say, that's love. That's a shame. That's destiny. That's children. Tender, but bored. The other friendships, which were a bit more turbulent, were the ones where they'd visit your private room. These could get to be just as boring as the first type, but were much more dangerous. They'd show up without prelude, just knock on the door, a strange quick knock, and say, let me in. They were rarely alone, almost always in threes, two men and a woman, or three men. The motives they put forth for such visits tended to be stupid or not too believable. To smoke a little weed, which they couldn't do in the group showers, or to sell us something or other. Lauda always let them in. The first few times, it made me tense, ready to fight and fall blood-soaked on the tiles of the private room. I figured the most logical thing was they were coming to rob us, or to rape Lauda, or even to rape me, and my nerves were on edge. The visitors knew this somehow, and they addressed me only when necessity or good manners made it impossible to avoid. All the propositions, deals, and whispers were addressed to Lauda. She was the one who let them in. She was the one who asked what the fuck they wanted. She was the one who let them pass through to the room with the divan. I would listen from the steam to how they sat down, first one, then another, then the next, and Lauda's back, unmoving, could be seen through the frosted glass door separating the steam from that antechamber, which had suddenly been transformed into a mystery. Finally, I'd get up, put a towel on my waist, and go in. Or a man, a boy, and a girl who would wave hesitantly when they saw me, as if all along, against all reason, they'd been expecting only Lauda and not the two of us, as if they'd only expected to find her. From the divan, their dark eyes never missed a single gesture of hers, while their hands, independently, rolled the weed. The conversation seemed coded in a language I didn't know, and certainly not in the teenage slang prevalent at that time, of which I now barely remember, but in a much more ominous slang, where each verb and each sentence had a touch of funeral and of holes. Maybe the air hole. Maybe one of the deformed faces of the immaculate grave. Maybe. Maybe not. In any case, I joined the conversation, or tried to. It wasn't easy, but I tried. Sometimes, along with the pot, they'd pull out bottles of alcohol. The bottles weren't free, but all the same, we never paid. The visitor's business was selling marijuana, whiskey, turtle eggs in the saunas, rarely with the approval of the receptionist or the janitorial staff, who relentlessly pursued them. That's why it was of the utmost importance that somebody shelter them. They also sold theater, which was really where they made their dough, or arranged private performances in the bachelor pads of contracting parties. The repertoire of these traveling companies could be paltry or multifarious, but the dramatic crux of their mise-en-scene was always the same. The older man stayed on the divan, thinking, I suppose, while the boy and girl, or the two boys, followed the spectators into the steam chamber. The performance, as a general rule, didn't last more than half an hour or three quarters of an hour, with or without the participation of the spectators. When the time was up, the man on the divan would open the door and announce to the respected public, between coughs brought on by the steam, which immediately tried to slip into the other room, the end of the show. Encores were very expensive, though they lasted only 10 minutes. The boys would shower quickly, then take their clothes from the man's hands. I remember they'd get dressed while they were still wet. The downcast but enterprising artistic director would take advantage of the last few minutes to offer satisfied viewers the delicacies in his basket or suitcase. Whiskey served in paper cups, joints rolled by expert hands, and turtle legs he'd open with his enormous thumbnail, and which he'd sprinkle with lemon and chili when they were in the glass. In our private room, Juana, they let time pass, checking their watches now and again as their faces became covered with beads of sweat. Sometimes they'd touch each other, touch us, something that was inevitable, regardless if we were all sitting on the divan. And the brushing of legs or arms could get to be painful. Not the pain of sex, but of the unpardonably lost, or of the last shred of hope roaming the impossible country. If they were acquaintances, Laura would invite them to undress and join us in the steam. They rarely accepted. They preferred to smoke and drink and listen to stories, to relax. After a while, they'd close the suitcase and take off. Then, two or three times in the same afternoon, they'd come back. The routine was the same. If she was in a good mood, Laura would let them in. If not, she wouldn't even bother to tell them through the door to quit bugging us. The relationships, with the exception of one or two isolated quarrels, were always harmonious. Sometimes I think they treasured Laura long before they even met her. One night, the old man who brought them, there were three of them that time, an old man and two boys, offered us a show. We'd never seen one. How much does it cost? I said. Nothing. Laura told them to come in. The steam room was cold. Laura took off her towel and turned the valve. Steam started rising from the floor. I felt like we were in a Nazi shower, and they were going to gas us. The feeling grew more intense when I saw the two boys come in, very skinny and dark, and behind them the old procurer, covered only by some indescribably dirty underpants. Laura laughed. The boys looked at her, a little shy, standing in the middle of the room. Then they too laughed. Without removing his horrific undergarment, the old man sat between Laura and me. Do you just want to watch or watch and participate? Watch, I said. We'll see, Laura said, very given to this sort of risk. The boys then, as if they'd heard a commanding voice, knelt down and started to lather each other's privates with soap. In their gestures, learned and mechanical, you could see how tired they were, and glimpse a series of tremors that could easily have been related to Laura's presence. Time passed. The room recovered its density of steam. The actors, however, motionless in their starting pose, seemed frozen, kneeling down face to face, but kneeling in a grotesquely artistic way, masturbating each other with the left hand while keeping balance with the right. They looked like birds, metal engravings of birds. They must be tired. They aren't getting it up, the old man said. Indeed, the soapy cocks pointed only timidly upward. Don't lose her, boys, the old man said. Laura started to laugh again. How do you expect us to concentrate if you keep laughing all the time? One of the boys said. Laura got up, passed by them, and leaned against the wall. Now the two tired performers were between us. I felt like time was tearing apart inside me. The old man mumbled something. I looked at him. He had his eyes closed and appeared to be sleeping. "We haven't slept in a long time," one of the boys said, letting go of his partner's penis. Lauda smiled at him. "Next to me." The old man started to snore. The boy smiled, relieved, and adopted a more comfortable posture. I heard their bones crack. Lauda let herself slide down the wall until her butt was on the tile. "You're very skinny," she said to one of them. "Me? He is too," the boy responded. "And you." In fact, we were all skinny. The whistle of the steam on occasion made it hard to distinguish the voices, which were too quiet. Lauda's body, back against the wall, knees lifted, was covered in sweat. The drops slid down her nose, down her neck, made grooves between her breasts, and even hung from her pubic hair before falling onto the hot tiles. "Or melting," I mumbled, and suddenly felt sad. Lauda nodded. She seemed so sweet at that moment. "Where are we?" I thought. With the back of my hand, I wiped away drops that slid from my eyebrows to my eyes and kept me from seeing. One of the boys sighed. "I'm so tired," he said. "Sleep," Lauda recommended. It was strange. I felt like the lights were dimming, losing intensity. I was afraid I might faint. Then I figured it must be the excess of steam changing the colors and tones so much darker now. As if we were seeing the sunset here, inside, without windows, I thought. Whiskey and Mary Jane are not good company. As if reading my mind, Lauda said, "Don't worry, everything's fine." Then she started smiling again. Not a mocking smile, not as if she were enjoying herself, but a terminal smile, a knotted smile somewhere between a sensation of beauty and misery, though not beauty and misery, per se, but little beauty and little misery, paradoxical dwarves, traveling and inapprehensible dwarves. "Relax, it's just steam," Lauda said. The boys, ready to accept everything Lauda said as irrefutable, nodded over and over. Then one of them let himself drop to the tiles, head propped on his arm, and fell asleep. I got up, careful not to wake the old man, and moved closer to Lauda, squatting next to her. I buried my face in her humid and fragrant hair. I felt Lauda's fingers caress my shoulder. In a little while, I realized that Lauda was playing very gently, but it was a game. Her pinky was sunbathing on my shoulder. Then her ring finger would pass, and they'd greet each other with a kiss. Then the thumb would appear, and both pinky and ring finger would flee down the arm. The thumb was then king of the shoulder and would lie down to sleep. It seemed to me that he even ate some vegetable that was growing there, for the fingernail dug into my flesh until the pinky and the ring finger returned, accompanied by the middle and index fingers, and all together they would frighten the thumb, who hid behind an ear and spied on the other fingers from there, without understanding why they'd thrown him out, while the others danced on the shoulder and drank and made love, and out of sheer drunkenness lost their balance and fell off the cliff and down the back, an accident Lauda would take advantage of in order to hug me and lightly touch her lips to mine. In the meantime, the four fingers, terribly bruised, would climb up again, clinging to my vertebrae, and the thumb would observe them without ever thinking to leave his ear. "Your face, it's glistening," I whispered. "Your eyes. the tips of your nipples. You too, Laura said, a little pale, I guess, but you're glistening. It's steam mixed with sweat. One of the boys was watching us in silence. Do you really love him? He asked Laura. His eyes were enormous in the black. I sat on the floor. Yes, Laura said. He must be madly in love with you, the boy said. Laura laughed like a housewife. Yes, she said. And with good reason, the boy said. Yeah, I said, with good reason. Do you know what steam mixed with sweat tastes like? It depends on the particular flavor of each person. The boy lay down next to his partner on his side, his temple pressed right against the tiles without closing his eyes. His cock was hard now. He touched Lauder's legs with his knees. He blinked a few times before speaking. Let's fuck a little, he said. Laura didn't answer. The boy appeared to be speaking for his own benefit. Do you know what a little steam mixed with a little sweat tastes like? What it would really taste like? What the flavor would be? The heat was putting us to sleep. The old man slipped until he was lying down completely on the bench. The sleeping boy's body had curled into a ball, his arm wrapped around the waist of the one who was awake. Laura stood and watched us at length from above. I thought she was going to turn on the shower, which would have had fatal effects on those who were sleeping. It's hot, she said. It's unbearably hot. If they weren't here, she was referring to the trio, I'd ask the bar to bring me a soda. You still can, I said. No one's going to come all the way in here. No, Laura said, it's not that. Or should I turn off the steam? No, Laura said. The boy, head slanted, stared fixedly at my feet. Maybe he wants to make love to you, Laura said. Before I could answer, the boy, almost without moving his lips, pronounced a laconic no. I was kidding, Laura said. Then she kneeled down beside him and with one hand caressed his buttocks. I saw in a fleeting and disturbing vision how the drops of sweat moved from the boy's body to Laura's and vice versa. The long fingers on my friend's hand and the boy's buttocks glistened, humid, and identical. You must be tired, Laura said. That old man is crazy. How can he expect you to fuck each other here? Her hand slid over the boy's buttocks. It's not his fault, he whispered. The poor guy's forgotten what a bed is. And what clean underpants are, Laura added. He'd be better off wearing nothing. Yeah, I said, it's more comfortable. Less awkward, the boy said, but wouldn't it be great to put on clean white underpants? Tight ones, but not too tight. Laura and I laughed. The boy scolded us calmly. Don't laugh, this is serious. His eyes seemed erased, gray eyes like cement in the rain. Laura grabbed his cock with both hands and yanked it. I heard myself saying, should I turn off the steam? But the voice was weak and far away. Where the fuck does your manager sleep? Laura said. The boy shrugged. You're kind of hurting me, he whispered. With one hand, I held on to Laura's ankle. With the other, I wiped away the sweat getting into my eyes. The boy straightened until he was sitting up, with a strained gesture, trying not to wake his partner, and kissed Laura. I bowed my head to see them better. The boy's lips, thick, sucked on Laura's lips, closed, where you could just barely make out a smile. I squinted. I'd never seen her smile so peacefully. Suddenly, the steam hit her. I felt a kind of detached terror, fear that the steam would kill Laura. When their lips separated, the boy said he didn't know where the old man slept. He put one hand to his neck and made a slicing gesture. Then he caressed Laura's neck and pulled her even closer. Laura's body, elastic, adapted to the new posture. Her gaze was fixed on the wall, on what the steam allowed her to see of the wall. Her torso forward, breast grazing the boy's chest or pressed against him with gentle strength. The steam at times made them invisible, or half covered them, or silvered them, or plunged them into something like a dream. Finally, it was impossible for me to see her. First one shadow on top of another shadow, then nothing. The chamber seemed about to explode. I waited a few seconds, but nothing changed. On the contrary, I got the impression that the steam was thickening more and more. I reached out a hand and touched Laura's back, arched on top of what I assumed was the boy's body. I stood and took two steps along the wall. I heard Laura calling me, a Laura with her mouth full. What do you want? I said. I'm suffocating. I went back, less carefully than before, and bent down, feeling my way around the place where I figured they must be. I touched only hot tiles. I thought I was dreaming or going crazy. I bit my hand so I wouldn't scream. Laura, I moaned. Beside me, the boy's voice sounded like distant thunder. The boy, according to whom steam mixed with sweat, tastes distinctly. I stood up again, this time ready to start kicking, blindly, but I checked myself. Turn off the steam, Laura said from somewhere. In fits and starts, I was able to get to the bench. While ducking to look for the main valves, I heard the old man's snores practically in my ear. He's still alive, I thought, and turned off the steam. At first, nothing happened. Then, before the silhouettes recovered their visibility, someone opened the door and exited the steam chamber. I waited. Whoever it was in the other room and making quite a bit of noise. Laura, I called quietly. No one answered. Finally, I could see the old man, still sleeping. On the floor, one in fetal position, and the other stretched out, the two actors. The insomniac appeared to really be sleeping. I jumped over them. In the room with the divan, Laura was already dressed. She threw me my clothes, without saying a word. What happened? I said. Let's go, Laura said. We saw this trio again a couple of times. Once at those same baths, the other time in Azcapotzalco, the baths of hell, as Laura called them, but things were never the same. At most, we smoked a cigarette, then adios. We kept visiting those places for a long time. We could have made love elsewhere, but there was something about the route of public baths that attracted us like a magnet. Obviously, there was no shortage of other incidents, desperate guys racing down hallways, an attempt at statutory rape, a raid we were able to avoid by luck and cunning. Cunning, Laura's, luck, the bronze solidarity of bathers. From the sum total of all the establishments, now just an amalgam that gets confused with Laura's smiling face, we mind the certainty of our love. The best of all, maybe because that's where we did it the first time, was Montezuma's gym, which we always went back to. The worst, a place in Casas Alemán, conveniently called the Flying Dutchman, which was the one that looked most like a morgue. Triple morgue of hygiene, of the proletariat, and of body. Not of desire. two memories I still have from back then are the most ingrained. The first is a succession of images of Laura, naked, on the beach, in my arms, under the shower, stretched out on the divan, thinking, until the steam, gradually increasing, makes her disappear completely. The end. Blank image. The second is the mural at Montezuma's gym. Montezuma's eyes, bottomless. Montezuma's neck, suspended above the surface of the pool. The courtiers, or maybe they weren't courtiers, who laugh and converse, trying with all their might to ignore whatever it is the emperor sees. The flocks of birds and clouds that mix together in the background. The color of the pool's rocks, doubtless the saddest color I saw in the course of our expeditions, comparable only to the color of some faces, workers in the hallways, whom I no longer remember, but who were certainly there. Okay, that was Roberto Bolaño's Mexican Manifesto, translated from the Spanish by Laura Healy. Roberto Bolaño, I think he died around 2000, so, yeah, 2003, actually 15th of July, 2003, that's when he died. I'm looking at that right now, and that is the first day I ever arrived here. Anyways, I never knew that. I guess I'm gonna read, see if I can get through a really quick, a really short story by another one of my faves. Good old Marcel Schwab. I don't really know what to say about Marcel Schwab, you know. I guess everybody liked him back in the day, 120 years ago. This is a book called Imagine, translated into English. I don't think this book was actually available as such when, you know, as it is now, it's like a compilation of a bunch of stories, but anyways, you get the drift. It's just a compilation of stories. I'm going to read this one story called Lucretius, Poet. Lucretius came from a great family that had withdrawn itself far from city life. His earliest days were spent in the shade of the black porch of a Villa Rustico that had been erected on the mountainside. The atrium was severe and the slaves were mute. He was surrounded from childhood by contempt for politics and for men. The noble Memmius, who was his same age, endured the games Lucretius imposed upon him in the forest. Together they were astonished by the wrinkles of the old trees, and they observed the trembling of the leaves beneath the sun, like a viridian veil of light scattered with spots of gold. They would often contemplate the striped backs of the wild swine as they huffed and sniffed at the earth. Their paths would cross simmering jets of bees and mobile armies of marching ants. And one day, as they came out of a thicket, they happened upon a clearing that was surrounded by ancient cork oaks, set so closely together that their circle cut a blue well into the sky. The peacefulness of that sanctuary was infinite. It seemed as if they were on a large, bright road that led into the highest heights of the divine sky. It was there that Lucretius learned to be moved by the benediction of calm places. Alongside Memmius, he left the serene temple that was the forest to study eloquence in Rome. The elderly nobleman who governed that grand country estate arranged for him a professor of Greek and instructed him not to return until he had mastered the art of holding in contempt all the deeds of men. Lucretius never saw him again. The nobleman died alone, abhorring the tumultuousness of society. When Lucretius returned to that imposing and empty estate, he brought with him into its severe atrium and among its mute slaves an African woman, beautiful, barbarous, and cruel. Memmius had returned to the house of his forefathers. Lucretius had seen the cruel factions, the warring parties, and the political corruption. He was in love. And at first his life was an enchanted one. The African woman learned the shaped mass of her hair, leaned the shaped mass of her hair against the wall coverings. The length of her body hugged the divans. She would drape herself around the cratars full of frothy wine, her arms laden with translucent emeralds. She had a strange way of raising a finger and shaking her head. Her smile came from a hidden source, as deep and mysterious as the rivers of Africa. Instead of spinning wool, she patiently tore it into tiny flakes, which fluttered around her. Lucretius ardently yearned to melt into that beautiful body. He clutched at her metallic breasts and fixed his mouth over her dark violet lips. The words of love passed from one to the other. They were exhaled in sighs, made them laugh, exhausted them. They touched the flexible and opaque veil that separates lovers. Their sensual delight grew more and more furious and wanted to fully move from one person to the other. It reached that acute extreme where it wraps itself around the flesh, yet without penetrating all the way to the entrails. The African woman withdrew into her foreign heart. Lucretius despaired that he would never succeed in love. The woman grew haughty, gloomy, silent, not unlike the slave's atrium. Lucretius roamed the house's library. It was there that he unrolled the scroll onto which a scribe had copied the treatise of Epicurus. Soon, he understood the variety of things in this world and the pointlessness of striving toward ideas. The universe seemed to him the same as the little flakes of wool that the fingers of the African woman scattered about the rooms. The clusters of bees and the columns of ants and the moving tissue of the leaves became for him groupings of atoms. And throughout his own body, he felt an invisible and dissenting population, eager to separate themselves from one another, and the gazes of others seemed to have become subtly fleshed out rays, and the image he saw of the beautiful barbarian a pleasant and colorful mosaic, and he felt that the final movements of this infinity were mournful and futile. Like the blood-spattered factions of Rome with their assembly of jeering armed clients, he contemplated the whirling vortex of assemblages of atoms stained by the same blood, disputing an obscure supremacy. And he saw that the dissolution brought about by death was nothing but the emancipation of this unruly rabble, which would then rush off toward a thousand other equally pointless acts. Once Lucretius had been educated thus by the roll of papyrus, upon which the Greek words, like the atoms of the world, were woven one into the next, he made his way out into the forest from the black porch of the great ancestral villa. And he saw the striped backs of the swine, their noses ever directed down into the earth. Then, crossing the thicket, he suddenly found himself in the center of the forest's serene temple, and his eyes dove deep into the blue well of the sky. It was there that he sat down to rest. From that place he contemplated the teeming immensity of the universe, all the stones, all the plants, all the trees, all the animals, all the men, with their different colors, their passions, their tools, and the history of those diverse things, and their births, and their maladies, and their deaths. And among the totality and necessity of death, he could clearly perceive the unique death of the African woman, and he cried. He understood that tears come from a specific movement of the small glands that lie underneath the eyelids, and that these glands are agitated by a procession of atoms released from the heart itself having been struck by a succession of color images which have loosed themselves from the surface of the body of the beloved woman. He knew that love is only caused by the swelling of atoms that want to join themselves to other atoms. He knew that the sadness caused by death is naught but the worst of earthly illusions, because the one who has passed has ceased to be unhappy, has ceased to suffer, whereas the one to grieve for the departed is more afflicted by his own sorrows and by gloomily contemplating his own death. He knew that we leave behind no double, no simulacrum to shed tears over its own corpse as it is laid out at its feet, but acutely understanding sadness and love and death, and knowing that they are pointless images when we contemplate them from the calm place where we must shut ourselves away, he continued to cry, and to crave love, and to fear death. This is why, having made his way back to the dark, imposing estate of his ancestors, he approached the beautiful African, who was simmering a concoction over the fire in a metal pot. For she, too, had pondered on her own, and her thoughts had made their way back to the mysterious source of her smile. Lucretius studied the still boiling beverage. Little by little, it grew clearer and took on the appearance of a cloudy green sky, and the beautiful African shook her head and raised a finger. And so Lucretius drank down the potion, and immediately afterward his reason vanished, and he forgot all the Greek words from the rolls of the papyrus, and for the first time, having gone mad, he knew love. And in that night, having been poisoned, he knew death. Okay, that was Marcel Schwab. His take on Lucretius. I don't really feel like I'm going to have time to finish this story, but I'll give it a shot. You've been listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, name of the show, Good Night, Norman. The date, 5th of February, 2019. 2024. Tomorrow, February 6th, is the birthday of the great Robert Nesta Marley, who's a fellow angel, I mean artist, Mr. Barrett, I suppose, has just left the building, or the planet. Aston Family Man, played on a lot of those Bob Marley songs, everybody loves, and knows so well. He just left the planet this weekend, so God bless Bob Marley and the Wailers. Once again, Bob Marley's birthday, February 6th, also the birthday of the late, great POTUS, Ronald Wilson Reagan, alias 666, Antichrist, and the man who started the shit we're in today, politically speaking, but the politicians are really the ones who are in this shit. The rest of us are cool. So it's actually their birthday. How about that? Both on the same day, Bob Marley and Ronald Reagan, two great leaders of two opposing forces. Well, you know what they say about opposites. Don't fight fire with fire. Can't bring down the emperor using the emperor's tools. Okay, this is Marcel Schwab. Probably going to be an excerpt because I got about 3 minutes left before I'm on my way, and you hopefully are already on yours. In fact, I'm sure that you're already on your way, because why should our ways differ? Petronius by Marcel Schwab, novelist. Petronius, novelist by Marcel Schwab. He was born in the days when street performers in green robes would make trained piglets jump through blazing hoops, when bearded porters in cheesy cherry-colored tunics would shell peas into silver dishes, standing before provocative mosaics at the entrances of villas where freedmen, jingling with sesterces, strove to win municipal positions in the provincial towns, when orators performed epic poems during dessert, when the language was overflowing with words from the Erga Stulum and bloated with redundancies from Asia. His childhood was spent amid such elegancies. He never wore the same Tyrian wool twice. Silver that had fallen to the floor in the atrium was swept up with the rubbish. Meals were composed of the most delicate and unexpected foodstuffs, and the cooks incessantly varied the architectural presentation of the victuals. There was no reason to be surprised upon cracking open an egg if one should find a fig pecker, nor any need to be concerned about slicing into a copy of a statuette by Praxiteles sculpted out of foie gras. The gypsum used to seal the amphorae was diligently gilded. Small boxes of Indian ivory contained intense perfume.